We're in for a wonderful treat tonight. It's a little bit like Rosh Hashanah. You know, you eat apples and honey. It's very sweet. You enjoy it. And at the same time, you have to do a lot of hard work on the Yamim Noraim and Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. And that's what I think Mordechai Finley offers us. A wonderful sense of self, a great pleasure of listening to someone deep and articulate, and also someone who brings us a message at the very time we need to hear it, because this is the time. Elul is the time to get ready to be transformed. And I can't think of anyone better to help us to be a midwife to that experience for all of us. Rabbi Finley is the founder, together with his wife Meirav, of Or HaTorah in L.A. He's of the former president and teaches liturgy and rabbinics at the Academy for Jewish Religion in L.A., which is a unique trans-denominational seminary training rabbis and cantors. He's on the faculty of the Wexner Heritage Foundation and is a fellow and serves on the summer faculty of the Hartman Institute in Jerusalem. Rabbi Finley earned his PhD in religion and social ethics from USC's School of Religion, and his rabbinical ordination from Hebrew Union College, Jewish Institute of Religion. He's long been a teacher of Kabbalah, mysticism, and Jewish spirituality, and he blends a mastery of the traditional sources, a deep understanding of the spiritual and mystic quest, and a sophisticated understanding of psychological process and theory. He also wrote a very moving article about his son serving in the military that I think many of you read in the Jewish Journal. He is someone who has created in West LA a unique congregation of people who are liberal, Jewishly liberal, and take Shabbat very seriously as something that is central to their lives. The kind of synagogue that I think is every rabbi's dream. And some rabbis, through sheer force of personality, intelligence, and dedication, are able to realize that dream. And so it is my great pleasure to introduce Rabbi Mordechai Finley.
It is really a pleasure and honor to be here. When I looked at the list of other speakers, Ari has done a truly outstanding job in bringing some of the finest and deepest minds in the Jewish world today. With all humility, I hope I live up to the skills of your other speakers, and I don't terribly tarnish Ari's reputation here. I want to thank Rabbi Rockless for that wonderful introduction. He and I are acquaintances and mutual admirers, sadly, from too afar. But oftentimes I hear wonderful things about his work down here, and God willing, one day I'll have an opportunity to give a similar introduction for you when you come up to Los Angeles and share some of your Torah up there. It is true that when I teach, I ask people to work with me, because it is not a great skill of mine to be a storyteller, an entertainer, and I know other speakers have a great ability to do that. My teaching comes out of a commitment that human beings have the capacity for inner transformation. And inner transformation only occurs through hard work. One has to begin with a desire to transform. And oftentimes people don't know they have the need. They don't have the will, they don't have the desire. So I want to say a quick word about where this commitment on my part came. When I was a young man in rabbinical school and years after, I had my own series of very powerful mystical kinds of experience. Majoring in religion didn't hurt because I had a language for understanding it, but it was something that was very private. So when I was in rabbinical school and in my doctoral work, I was in training to become a Talmud teacher and a Jewish legal scholar. And when I worked at a congregation, first here in Irvine for several years and then at Stephen Weiss Temple, I began officiating at many funerals, especially as a junior rabbi at Stephen Weiss Temple. And as the juniorest rabbi of a congregation of 3,000 families, and I was the most junior, I officiated at funerals oftentimes of the former members and the grandparents and so forth. And I heard tragic stories. Not just tragic stories of deaths. I heard tragic stories of lives. of people who could not communicate love, people who hurt their wives and children, people who hurt their husbands and wives, people who did not live life nobly. And they could have done better. They could have been better spouses, better children to their parents. I saw so much human waste, so much human potential lost. And I remember oftentimes hearing sermons about social action and politics and so forth, and I would look across the room and I would see a person who just lost a mother, just lost a father, just lost a child, and wondering how to live with that. And I remember making an early commitment that I would try to focus on the heart, the spirit, how people can live nobly from the sources of the Jewish tradition in a few ways. First of all, in intimacy with each other. The quality of your life is probably depends more than anything on how willing the people in your family are to living nobly. If you live with a person who wants to live nobly, wants to grow in wisdom, in thoughtfulness, in empathy, in civility, your life can be wonderful. And if we live with people who are not committed to civility and thoughtfulness and depth and wisdom, our lives can be miserable. Spouses, children, other people. Same with people at work. So if you want to improve the world from this perspective, as a Kabbalistic perspective, the first thing you try to do is improve yourself, improve the life of people around you. Lots of folks have struggle in the interpersonal world, in work, and trying to make the world a better place, oftentimes because they're such unfinished products themselves. I also believe that people should work on the relationship with God, that if one can imagine that there is a fountain flowing through each of us that can bring great healing and great joy and great wisdom into our lives, if we just unblock the fountain. Now, there are some folks who don't believe in God, and they prefer a different language. So you can imagine higher consciousness, the upper limit of one's potential. It resides in every single human being. But most of us human beings have simply not devoted the time, the energy, and the skills to unblocking that fountain within, whether it comes from the deepest parts of the self or whether it comes from a Kadosh Baruch Hu, whether it comes from God. It doesn't matter where the fountain comes from as much as we don't allow it to flow through us. So that's my life commitment, personally and as a rabbi. So, clearly I'm interested in what's called Jewish spirituality. What is spirituality? Very simple. The word spirit in English comes from the Latin, which has the sense of breath. You say to aspire, perspire, and so forth. And you see this idea in the Bible when Adam Kadmon, the primordial human being, is just an inert matter. And he has breathed into him a nishmat chayim, a neshama. So the neshama, or neshama, gives Adam the capacity to, we might say, fulfill that potential living in God's image. So we each have a neshama, the divine breath. So spirituality, if you're looking for a definition, there are many ways to define spirituality. One way to define spirituality is concerned with the fact that the divine breath is within us. As one person put it, might have been Alan Liu, every time we breathe in, God is breathing out. Every time we breathe out, God is breathing in. Okay? But we're just not aware that we're breathing with the divine. So the problem of the human condition is that the divine is present within us, but we're not aware of it. Now, why are we not aware of it? There's an aspect to every human being that is clearly talked about in the Bible, but the rabbis theorize about it. And this aspect, according to the rabbis, is called the Yetzer Hara. Yetzer is from the Hebrew word litzor, which means to create or shape or form. And in Hebrew, a yetzer is like an urge, creative urge to do something. Ra means evil or destructive. So every human being, in addition to having a neshama, the divine breath within us, has what's called the Yetzer Hara. Now, in Hasidic sources, the word they use for the Yetzer Hara is ha'anochi, okay, the I self. We would call that the ego mind. And by ego mind, here's what we mean, and we need to be very careful about this. The Yetzer Hara, the urge toward destruction, is not evil, just as the ego is not evil. In the Chabad tradition, Lubavitch tradition, they give the following image. You have rider and horses. As long as the rider is controlling the horses, things are correct. But when the horses start to control the rider, things go awry. So the neshama, the soul, should be in charge of the Yetzer Hara. So when you have ambition and urges and things driving from you from the will, the neshama should control the will. The problem with most of us is Our neshama is not in control. The soul part of ourself is not running our lives. The yetzer hara is sometimes running wild, and the soul hides. The soul hides because it's not at home in that kind of a life. So we can think of a person aspiring to many different things except honesty, authenticity, goodness, kindness, and so forth. Oftentimes when I ask young people, what do you want to be in life? You know, what do you want? What kind of person do you want to be? Few people naturally talk about temperament and character. So one part of Jewish spirituality is realizing we have souls, we have the yetzer hara, and one thing we're supposed to do as Jews, this is part of our religion, is to allow the soul to dominate our lives. What we're supposed to do is minimize the yetzer hara and live as authentic people of high character with each other, with the world at large, and certainly in communion with the divine. So what does spirituality have to do with religion? Before I get into the high holiday, the holidays, I want to just set up a theory here. On one hand, spirituality can be something very private. And certainly up in LA, and it's probably similar down here, I deal with people who say to me, I'm spiritual, but not religious. Have you heard this before? Okay. So what they're more or less saying is this. Traditional religion hasn't worked for me because its religious forms and narratives are empty. They don't speak for me. I found and adapted my own spirituality. I said, well, where'd you come up with this? They said, well, I listened to my inner heart. I read a few books. I learned one thing or another, took some seminars. And I get the image that they come home with all this different information. They put it in the blender, hit frappe, and pour it out, and they have a religious tradition. Now, I'm caricaturing a little bit, but by the way, and it works. When I say to people who are conscious and hard at work, these traditions work. But here's the problem with them. They're private, idiosyncratic, and almost ultimately self-referential. Since they've created it, it doesn't have within it the capacity to critique them and challenge them and push them forward. It's not transmittable over generations. It's not present in stages of life. Marriage, bar bat mitzvah, birth, divorce, and death, and so forth. It's a private connection with spirit that has no communal celebratory dimension. So when people say to me, I'm spiritual but not religious, I say to them, every religion that I know of has the capacity to be renewed by spiritual people. The best option in life, I think, for every one of us, and I'm talking to a Jewish group today, obviously, is to be awakened spiritually and invest our religiosity with that spiritual awakening. So there, if you look at all the different aspects of Judaism, prayer, study of Torah, and so forth, each of these can be a dead letter to anybody who doesn't invest it with spiritual devotion, doesn't learn of one's own spirit and the spiritual potential there. By the same token, across the board, Reform all the way to Orthodox, you can take any ritual dimension that we have, invest it with spirit, and it can be a live teacher for you. So let's talk about narrative for a moment. What are the narratives of the Bible? On one hand, I have people why don't you like reading the Bible? So what's your approach to the Bible? Well, isn't the Bible basically history and ethics? Okay, how many have heard that before? History of the Jewish people and source of ethics. So if you think the Bible is a source of history and ethics, you're in for big trouble. Okay? First of all, most historians critique the historicity of the Bible. Right? And number two, if you're going to look for ethics, you'll find some highly unethical people in the Bible. Okay, doing unethical things all the time. Even the greatest Jews, you know, Abraham, I can tell you all over the story of Abraham, he does not so nice things to other people, including trying to murder his son, right? And, you know, you could take that down the line. So when people say, I read the Bible for history and ethics, I say, look, that's one level. But spiritually speaking, there's another way to read the Bible. And this way to read the Bible, I first read as a rabbinical student in a book by Larry Kushner called River of Light. The first half of the book is devoted to this idea. It's not original with him, but I think he articulated it the best, at least at the time when I was interested in this idea. And that is that the Bible is a map, the Jewish map to the soul. It's the collective unconscious of the Jewish people. So it's more like a dream. When you have a dream and you're doing something unethical, immoral, wrong, or strange, you don't say, oh, since it's not ethical and it's not historical, I'm not going to pay attention to it. Because it's telling you something about your own life. So we study the Bible because it's a narrativization of the soul. It's one of the ways that we Jews read the soul. So one thing that we try to do during the holidays is try to look at the biblical narratives connected to the holidays, because those biblical narratives teach a narrative about our own souls. And that's where I want to take you tonight. So here are my premises. Each of you have souls. Each of you has a yetzer hara. Each of you is Jewish, or for some reason tonight brought to a Jewish place. The Jewish people has a map to the soul. If you study this map carefully, you can undergo a transformation to the kind of a person where the consciousness of the soul is the dominant consciousness in your life. That's my goal for myself and all my teaching. That's my goal for tonight. So I want to tell you a little bit of the story that takes us to Yom Kippur. First of all, we come out of Egypt, and you know the narrative well, where we're trapped in Egypt in very tragic circumstances. When we come out of Egypt, the line that tells us most about this tragedy is that when we come, for example, to the Red Sea, and the people freeze up and they think they're going to die. They can't stand the idea of going forward. And Moshe's crying out to God, and God says to Moshe, "Why are you crying out to me?" And there's a midrash, a wonderful midrash that says, somebody put their foot into the water, and when they put into the foot in the water, the sea opened up. Have you heard this midrash before? Okay. Do you know, anybody remember who that guy was? Nachshon ben Aminadab. Very good. So Nachshon ben Aminadab at some point said to himself, "I'd rather die trying to get across than go back there." Now, spiritually speaking, there's a deep truth there. Because the thing that keeps us from changing is the Yetzer Hara is afraid of death. It's afraid that if you become noble, if you become dignified, if we grow, some small part of us dies. And that's absolutely true. And those small parts don't want to die. I'll give you an example. Have you ever had advice in a situation where someone says, "Look, somebody here has to forgive somebody to get this repair going. Somebody has to be the first to say, 'I'm sorry, I take it back.'" Now, I say this all the time in family counseling. And guess what I oftentimes hear from each person? "Why do I always have to be first? I'm always the one saying I'm sorry. I'm always the one that has to forgive. I'm tired of being the saint." Well, which part of your being is speaking, the Yetzer Hara or the Neshama? Because the Neshama never gets tired of being a saint. It aspires to saintliness. The Yetzer Hara never is saintly but claims it's tired from doing it too much. Okay? And that's in a sense our trait. So Nachshon says, "I'm willing to die. I'd rather die than stay that way. I'd rather die than stay in an Egypt of soul and personality." So Nachshon wants to go for it. But you can imagine one guy, Nachshon, goes for it, but everybody else says, "Okay, he went, let's go next. You know, I'm glad he went first because I wouldn't have gone first. But since he went first, I'll follow his tracks. Sea opens up, we go through." So here's what we find. We find the people of Israel, even though they're taken into what we might call freedom, political freedom from Pharaoh, their hearts and minds and souls are not yet free. They've been battered by Egypt. Okay. Now the question is, when do we become free, and what does freedom mean? So here's some interesting theories of freedom. Now we have a freedom, a regnant definition of freedom among us is freedom is the freedom to do whatever you want outside of government control. We have a secular liberal idea of freedom. But the traditional Jewish idea of freedom is very different. The traditional Jewish idea of freedom is you're free from inner impediments to do what is right. So Judaism understands there typically is a spiritually and morally right way to live, right way to think. Does Judaism tell you how to think? Yes. Does Judaism teach you how to feel? Does Judaism say you can feel whatever you want? How many of you have heard? Judaism doesn't tell you what to think or feel, it just tells you about action. Have you ever heard that before? Not true. It says in the Bible, don't hold grudges. Are you allowed to say, "I'm permitted to hold a grudge as long as I don't act on it"? Is that Jewish? No. Judaism commands you, don't hold grudges. Commands you, love your neighbor as yourself. Just this last week's Torah portion, when it talked about sharing our wealth with the poor, it said, don't be hard-hearted. When you let that poor person go, don't be stingy. Don't let your heart be hard. Be soft-hearted in letting the person go. All over the Torah, Psalms, and Proverbs, we have advice to the Jewish people that our hearts, our emotions, must be involved in what we do in the interpersonal world. It's not just about being ethical. It's about a kind of a temperament and a kind of a character. So here's what we find. Going to Mount Sinai and getting the law would not be enough, because the law was not there to be obeyed. The law was there to transform us. And how do we know that? Think about the Ten Commandments. I have people that say to me, "You know, Rabbi, you know, I don't daven, I don't go to shul, but I keep the Ten Commandments." I say, "You keep the Ten Commandments. That's wonderful." I say, "Shabbos?" They go, "Is that one of them?" I said, "Yes." They say, "Okay, 9 out of 10. I said, 9 out of 10 is good in anybody's book. Haven't murdered? I don't murder. Commit adultery? No, I don't commit adultery. Steal? steal. Okay, define steal. Okay, so we move forward. Covet. Covet. Sounds goyish. That's there? I said, yes. What's covet? I said, want something that belongs to somebody else. You're not supposed to do that? I said, it's Ten Commandments. They're surprised. You mean God's telling me how to feel? I mean, okay, I don't steal it, but I can't want it? You can't even want it. Well, this is impossible. I said, that's right. Anybody who says, I follow the Ten Commandments is a liar. And that's why it's there. It's there for you to say, you can start with, I don't kill. Okay, you don't kill anybody. You can start with, I don't commit adultery, I don't steal. Okay. But don't go around polishing the medals on your chest. Because God gives in the Ten Commandments a bottom limit that we don't go under, but also gives us something to reach toward that no human being can grasp. It sets our spiritual ambition. It sets a goal right outside of our grasp. Don't even covet. Don't even want it. A person could say, how could I possibly not go around wanting things I can't have? And God says, you finally have a good question. You finally have a good question. Because if you can say to yourself, if when you wake up in the day and you say to yourself, how can I control my thoughts and emotions? God is saying, thank you. That's what I want you to be asking. God seems to be saying to us in the Ten Commandments, I don't expect you to be able to live this perfectly, but I expect you to ask the question. So we come to Mount Sinai, and here's what the tradition says. We come to Sinai, we get arranged, Moshe goes up on the mountain. Now, when Moshe, on the 6th of Sivan, goes up on the mountain, we're down below, and the ten words, Aseret HaDvarim, the Ten Commandments are revealed to us. And according to the tradition, we say Na'aseh V'Nishma, which means, what does it mean? We will do it, and we will hear it, we will obey it. It's not exactly clear, but something like, we will obediently do this whole thing. Now, here's what the tradition says about this. It says, at that moment, we repaired the exile from the Garden of Eden. What happened in the Garden of Eden? God gave Adam and Eve very little mitzvahs. Okay? He said, L'ovda l'shomra, guard it and observe it, tend it, very interesting language. And he says, okay, you can eat anything you want. The tree in the middle of the garden, don't eat from it. So of course, what happened to Adam and Eve? They couldn't stop thinking about it. So there's a wonderful teaching that says that the snake is really an extension of their souls, of their desires, and they finally eat from it, and they're exiled from the garden. And there's a great truth there. The great truth is, if you think about it just for a moment, oftentimes in our lives, in moments of spiritual lucidity, we have been given what we need. You've been given what you need. But there's also something in our character that always wants something else. That's always restless, always critical of other people, critical of ourselves, always lacking, doesn't stay satisfied. So that's that energy of Adam and Chava, where they look at the tree and they say, the one thing we can't have, we must have. So they eat from Eitz Da'at, tree of knowledge, and they're exiled from the garden. Which tree stays in the garden that they don't touch? Eitz HaChaim, the tree of life. They're pushed out. So we live in exile. We live in exile because we couldn't live within the parameters of what we were given. Now, again, there's so much wisdom here. Let me just give you one side of it. Oftentimes when I counsel people morally, and they're very honest with me, we get to a point of honesty, I say to them, so you're telling me you knew better. Almost everybody says, I knew better. I knew better. So here's what I find. Most moral problems are not problems of moral confusion. They're problems of moral weakness. They do know the difference between right and wrong. They're not strong enough to do the right thing, for most of us. So that's Adam and Chava. We're taken to Mount Sinai, and God wants us human beings to repair this, and initially with the people of Israel. So what happens? God says, I'm going to give you a Torah, a teaching, that's going to be a straight teaching that's going to heal your hearts, help you live morally with each other, and link you to me. And the Jewish people say, we'll do it. We're up to it. We're going to do it. We'll obey it. At that moment, the taint of Eden was banished. Okay. Moshe goes up on the mountain for 40 days. Now, why does he go up for 40 days? What have you heard? Any theories? Okay. Get it in writing. There's lots of, right? Yeah, he wanted to go up and get the fullness of the teaching while we waited down below. So here is the first thing I want you to think about. We know what happens to Moshe up there because we have the next parshiot. We have Mishpatim, we have Truma, Tetzaveh, the beginning of Ki Tisa. Moshe's up there getting revelation, filled with revelation. What are the people down on the bottom of the mountain doing? What are they doing? Not yet, not to the 40th day. They build the golden calf at the last minute. What are they doing for the 39 previous days? Complaining, worrying, whining. Okay, so we have this image. They're ruining those two words. Someone said, did you say Adas? I didn't say it. Who said it? First, they want to find out who said Na'aseh v'nishma. We should have seen it first. We should have got it in writing. We should have known what we were getting into. Okay, they had a committee to study it. They wanted to find out what happened. So they're down there doing a lot of work. Now, and there's interesting interpretation of this, but here's the main thing that I've seen is we oftentimes know exactly what to do in moments of moral clarity. There's a spiritual lucidity that we have. And then the Yetzer Hara says, what did you just do? Why did you commit yourself to this? And I got to tell you, one time I remember when I read about this in a Hasidic text. I remember some people know that in my many different times that I lived in Orange County, one of them was over here in El Toro when I was in the Marine Corps. And there was one night when I was the barrack sergeant. And there's a big argument going on. So I walk up, and there's these two enlisted men, two real big guys. And they're screaming at each other. It's going to get violent. So this one guy had gone into another guy's area and was, I'm going to beat you. And I get this big guy, right? And he sees my sergeant stripes. I can pull him aside. And I'm looking in a raging face. I said, if you go in there again and you touch him, you're going to go to jail. Do you understand that? He says, yes, sergeant. I said, I don't want to call the MPs. I don't want you to go to jail. I said, whatever it is, we can work it out in the morning. Go back to your room. Go to sleep. I'll be here in the morning. We'll work out. He says, yes, sergeant. So you understand me. I'm walking you back to your room. I'm not going to lock you in. You're going to go to sleep. He says, yes, sergeant. I said, okay. I'm back in his room. I go down. About 5 minutes later, I hear the raging again. I go up. They're in a fight. I call the MPs. He's taken off, right? And I remember thinking to myself, what happened to this guy? There was a fantastic urge in him that, you know, I could see when I was talking to him that the beast quieted and he spent a few minutes alone and the beast came back up. So here's what happens. We all have moments of clarity, and then whatever it is, the mazik inside of us, that urge inside of us comes back out. So here's the theory. We're sitting down there and we're saying a couple of things. We don't want to be such noble people. We don't want to be so good. We don't want to live by this law. Others are saying there's no possible way that we can live up to it. I can't live up to this standard. So when Moshe is a little bit late, why was Moshe late? Moshe says, I'm going to come down how long? 40 days, morning or afternoon. Okay? He meant, I'm going to leave the top of the mountain in 40 days, correct? So what time would he come back? Afternoon. They thought 40 days meant morning of the 40th day. So when he didn't show up the morning of the 40th day, what did they think? Okay, he's not coming back. In fact, the text says they saw Boshesh Moshe Laredet Min Hahar, right? That he was Boshesh. Now, what does Boshesh mean? To tarry or to wait. But what is the root of the word Boshesh? Interesting root. Busha, embarrassment. Okay, it's as if they had a moment of inner embarrassment, and some commentators say the following. They were both afraid that Moshe was dead and hoping he was dead. So they built the calf as a way of expressing, we're out of the bargain. Moshe's late, we're going to go do something else. They acted out their panic and their infidelity. Now, let's think for a moment that one of us, in a moment of anger, despair, envy, contentiousness, has something inside of us going on. Right? You know, I do a lot of leadership training. And oftentimes I'll go to a board and I'll say, what's going on? I find that people talk nasty to each other, for example. They put each other down. They say unkind things. And I share with people, you know, we all know the right way to speak. We all know how we're supposed to talk to each other. So what happens inside? Something builds up so big that it has to come out. So there's a wonderful book recently written by a Jewish Buddhist. Title of the book is, Don't Just Do Something, Sit There. Okay? So here's what I have found. Most people just don't know how to contain. They don't know how to say, I'm feeling something very strong, unmanageable. I think I'll just do nothing. I'll say nothing. I'm just going to hold it inside. Because what's happening inside of us is an errant spirit. The rabbis call it ruach shtut. A silly, errant spirit is trying to take over what we do. And there's a moment in our lives when we can either control it or not. So we had this moment of creating the molten calf. Moshe comes down from the mountain. He has the tablets in his hands. Now let's think for a moment where these tablets came from. Tablets were given to Moshe by God, okay, according to the tradition. They're given to him by God, and where does Torah come from the mystical perspective? The Torah is the inner life of God. It's the inner truth of God that is translated out into the historical, linguistic, and material form. So the tablets are understood to be a ketubah between God and the people of Israel, a marriage contract. But you know, a marriage contract doesn't mean anything if it's not willed by a power of love and commitment and covenant. When Moshe sees this, he takes the tablets and they break. Now, in many places in the Jewish tradition, for example, Jeremiah, it talks about tablets being written on our hearts. And I don't think it's an accidental image, because I think the deeper message here is that we broke God's heart. That God had a teaching for us to make us noble. I want us to think for a moment. You have a child. You've given a child a noble teaching to help them. And then you find your child doing something which rejects your teaching and which scorns your teaching. Now, some of us will just get mad. And some of us are heartbroken, because we've given them a teaching that could heal them, and they've scorned and rejected our teaching. Many parents in this room have had heartbreak from our children, because our children do destructive things, and we can see them destroying their lives, and we don't know how to stop them. God had that kind of moment. God looked at us destroying our lives, and God went through a moment of heartbreak. God said, I can't be in covenant with you if you're going to scorn and reject my teachings. From a non-theological perspective, you might say that every human being has within him or her the capacity for a life of consciousness and nobility. And there's some part of us, a ruach shtut, that defames that and betrays that and has us go down another path. So there's a great breakage now between God and the people of Israel. So what happens with Moshe and God is that Moshe has to get forgiveness from the people. He goes up for 40 days. He comes down, tells the people that they're forgiven, goes up for 40 days to communicate the forgiveness. Finally, everything is arranged, where the people are truly contrite and God is really ready to forgive them. Then Moshe is going to go up on the mountain for the last 40 days. So what does he do? By the way, the last 40 days, the anniversary of Moshe's going up on the mountain for the last 40 days is coming up in a few days, the first of Elul. Moshe goes up the mountain for those 40 days. And that's the title of my talk. The title of my talk is The Long Hot Summer of 1311 BCE. What did the Jewish people do during those first couple 40 days, but especially starting in Elul, this last 40-day period? Let's try to imagine it. So here's my imagination. Lots of people saying, you know what I think? And someone saying, you know, stop thinking. I have a thought. Just hold the thought. I want to tell you something. Think about it before you say it. People not doing something, people sitting there. A whole month of people contemplating. And I have a friend, and limiting speech, limiting eating, limiting action. I have a friend, Orthodox rabbi friend, who had never heard of what's called a tzom dibur, a speech fast. Never heard of it. But he had a very pious uncle in Yerushalayim. And so he went to meet him, and he knocked on the door. His uncle opens the door, and he says, Shalom, Shmi Danny, me America. And his uncle nodded. So he thought he was deaf, so he raised his voice a little bit. Shalom, Shmi Danny, me America. He nodded. And so my friend is shouting at him, so finally he takes out a little piece of paper, and it says, Chodesh Elul Tzom Dibur. Month of Elul, speech fast. Now, why do the highly pious go on a speech fast during the month of Elul? Because they're aware of something. That a lot of the sinning that we do in anger and gossip and so forth comes from speech. So what is the month of Elul? The month of Elul for us is a time of heightened consciousness on how we speak, how we think, how we feel, and how we behave. It's a time of heightened regimen, heightened sense of spiritual practice, heightened sensitivity to all aspects of our lives in preparing for the day that Moshe comes down the mountain. Now, Moshe is going to come down the mountain on the 40th day. So here's our question for ourselves. What do we do on the 40th day? How do we bring Moshe back down? Okay, now we're afraid. What did we do on the 40th day back a few months back? We had a big party, a big celebration, got out of hand. So what are we going to do on this day? So this, the tradition is that we said to ourselves, let's fast, let's don't eat, let's don't have sex, let's be very careful. We're going to sit here in complete silence because they're afraid that there's going to that the closer it gets, the destructive side of ourselves is going to get out of control. So as we sit for that moment, Moshe comes down the mountain on that day, and that day in the Jewish tradition is Yom Kippur. Okay? So on Yom Kippur, 40 days after, a few days from now, is the day that we receive Moshe back into our midst. Moshe comes back into our midst, Jewish people receive him, and the second tablets are now given to us. So part of the celebration of Yom Kippur is the re-receiving of the Torah from Sinai. The first time we blew it, the second time we get it. What happens on the next day? What happens on the 11th of Tishri? Okay. According to the Torah. Does anybody know what happens in the next day in Exodus chapter 35? It's Torah portion Vayakhel, where there's a pouring out of gifts to house the tablets. Okay. And the pouring out of gifts to house the tablets begins the building of the Mishkan. 5 days later is the which Jewish holiday? Sukkot. So what is Sukkot now from this perspective? From this narrative, Sukkot isn't just the Jewish agricultural holiday. Sukkot is the holiday that celebrates the Jewish people building the Mishkan, the tabernacle, to house the tablets that we rejected months ago. Now, the Mishkan, if you look at the building of the Mishkan, does anybody know, this is a good question for Jewish trivia, what the main motif is in the curtains and on top of the ark in the Mishkan? What is it? The cherubs, the kruvim. Okay. How many people have heard of cherubs, kruvim? Raise your hand. How many people knew that sewn into the curtains of the Mishkan were images of kruvim? How many of you knew that? Okay. So you go back to Torah portion Truma. That on top of the Aron Kodesh, with the Ten Commandments inside, were two figures. Those two figures were kruvim. Okay. Now I'm sure at least one or two of you know this. When was the last time we saw kruvim in the Bible? Who said it? Go ahead. The Garden of Eden. What are the kruvim doing according to the book of Genesis? Standing at the entrance of the Garden of Eden, protecting the tree of life. That's the last time we saw them. Where are they now? In the Mishkan. So what is the Mishkan by this, according to this theory? The Mishkan is what? Is the gate to the Garden of Eden, guarding the tree of life. What do we call Torah in our Torah service? We call the Torah the Eitz Chaim. So what this narrative tells us is every human being, and Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young wrote a song about this, want us to get back to Eden. Okay, what is Eden? Eden is a time when we live in harmony with God, harmony with each other. Okay, you might say that the human being is brought to our fullest potential. We abandon that. And oftentimes during this period, we have to ask ourselves at different moments in life, in our marriages, with our families, in our religious lives, when we've abandoned moments of fulfillment and how we can find our way back. So what are we taught? There is a way back to Eden. There's a teaching that we're given that takes us back to Eden. But how is it that we get there? The way we get there is the following. First of all, during the month of Elul, a time of great introspection and care in thought, speech, and deed. Secondly, you conclude that with a time of fasting where we wait for a moment of a re-receiving of the teaching. Third, a celebration of the teaching by living in Sukkot, which is a metaphor for building structures of life that make that holy teaching home there, a place that create lives that can be habitable for that teaching. And then around that teaching we see is the entrance to the tree of life. So here's the most interesting thing as we finish this narrative. Is around the 13th, 14th century, a new holiday came into existence. I think it's the last holiday created by the Jewish people until Zionist holidays. Y'all know what holiday that is? Simchas Torah. Simchas Torah happens at the end of Sukkot. And I thought to myself, what impelled people to create the holiday of Simchas Torah? It's not rabbinic. It's not even late rabbinic. Right? And it finally occurred to me. Can any of you see now what the holiday of Simchas Torah is? What is the holiday of Simchas Torah repairing? Okay. The day Moshe came down from the mountain. When Moshe came down from the mountain, they were dancing with the golden calf. After all this work, we finally have a holiday where we're no longer dancing with the golden calf. What are we doing? We're dancing with the Torah. So the holiday of Simchas Torah is the tikkun of the 17th of Tammuz, when Moshe came down the mountain and discovered people with the molten calf. Okay, that's the narrative I want to teach you. I have a little next section that I want to share with you, but are there any questions and comments based on this narrative? Any questions, comments, or thoughts? Okay, the second part I want to share is people ask me at this time is exactly what kind of inner processes that we observe during the month of Elul, and I want to give you a little direction on the practice. It's a theory about the mind that comes mostly for me from a book by the Ramchal, Rabbi Moshe Chaim Lutzato, called the Mesilat Yesharim, where he tells us that we're actually able to see our thought, our speech, and our deeds. I want to tell you a little bit about this practice, and hopefully you'll use it, for your own spiritual and moral growth. The idea is based on this, that usually when we look at the way we react to life, we see that there are activating events. For example, someone insults you or treats you badly, and a consequence, which typically is anger. And according to the Zohar, anger is one of the worst emotions we can feel, because it's almost entirely a worship of our own hurt feelings. So what we're taught in Mesilat Yesharim is that all of our actions that we do in the world, everything we feel and speak and do, is based on belief systems that are at the core of our being. So I want to give you an example of a little counseling session I recently had with a person who was insulted by another person. And the person said to me, another person said to me that I'm nosy and I'm a busybody and all these things, and therefore I'm upset with them. I said, what's your belief? My belief is that they shouldn't talk this way to me, that I'm only doing it for a good reason, and they should get off my back. I said, is that rational to you? Yes. So what kind of person does it make you into by believing that? She says, what do you mean? I said, are you angry? I'm angry and I feel contentious. We finally agreed. So I said for a moment, is that the kind of person you want to be? Do you want to be an angry, contentious person? Now, you know what I'm thinking about. I'm thinking about those funerals that I do. I'm thinking about the kids who said, Dad was a great provider, but he was always angry. Mom took care of us, but she was always depressed. And here's what I realized as I'm counseling this person. She had not made a decision what kind of person she wants to be. And here's how to do it in a very real way. It's your funeral. The rabbi has gathered your family around, as I do. And I say, first tell me the truth, then we'll figure out what I'm going to say. Okay? I'll say kind, good things, but I don't want to walk on thin ice. I don't want to get up there and talk things that are clearly are not true. So tell me what's really going on, and we'll figure out a way to honor your mom or dad. And I hear sad stories. I hear good stories. I hear lots of sad stories. Okay? And as I'm sitting there hearing these stories, I say to myself, I wonder if this person ever sat down in their life and wrote down on a piece of paper what kind of person they want to be. And that's what I want you to do. I want you to write down. You want them to say after you die, empathetic, wise, mature, thoughtful, forgiving. Do you want them to say that? Write down what you want them to say and then ask yourself, in what ways are you living that when you pass away, it'll be so clear who you are and what you stand for that the people who know you the best, the folks who know you in the community, without a second's hesitation, write those things down. Here's my challenge to myself and you. If you don't write it down and you live your life around it, it's not going to happen. You know what it's going to be? It's going to be a value you run up the flagpole and salute and say, I believe in peace and harmony. And by saluting it and liking it, you think you've done something. You feel good about yourself. But lots of folks who believe in peace and harmony and salute the flag of peace and harmony don't do the spiritual, intellectual, and emotional work of transformation that really reveres that thing. The reverence is lip service, not service of the heart. So I said to this woman, I said to her, do you want to be an angry woman? Because I knew that other people knew her to be an angry woman. She says, no, but I have a right to be angry. That's right, you have a right to be angry. Do you want to be an angry woman? After a lot of work, she finally said, no, I don't like being angry. I said, let's try on another belief. I want you to believe that when you work with other people, they're going to have bad moments and they're going to say thoughtless things. And that's what happens when you work with people. They have bad moments, you have bad moments. And whenever someone has a bad moment, you should look up and say, look, I know you had a bad moment. I'm not going to take it that seriously. We got to work together. I'm over it. And truly be over it, not just say it. Now, which belief is the better belief? She said, what do you mean better belief? How can one belief be better than another? And I said one of these shocking things. And it was shocking to myself when I first thought it, and it's shocking to people when I say it to them. The better belief is the belief that creates the better person. People think beliefs are true and then create actions. And a combination of actions creates a character and a temperament. Jewish moral theory says something else. Decide the kind of person you want to be. Create beliefs that create that person. So I said, believe that people have bad moments when they work together. People say things they don't mean. And the best thing to do is just let it go and get over it. Or believe that every time someone says something insulting to you or about you, you should get really mad at them and hold it for as long as possible. Either one fits. One creates a chronically angry person. One creates a forgiving, wise, and empathetic person. Which one do you want to be? And that's the last thing I want to leave you with when we learn this, our story. We're at the bottom of Mount Sinai. We feel we can't live up to this. We act precipitously. We didn't agree. We were thoughtless. We wanted to act out. People expressing their anxiety. Somebody else could have said, look, I believe that was the God who brought us out of Egypt. I believe this God only wants the best for us. I believe there's a noble way to live. I believe we should just wait till Moshe gets back and see what happens. Two possibilities for belief. One set of beliefs creates the molten calf, rational beliefs. One set of beliefs creates spiritually and morally disciplined people who find their way back to Eden. This last week's Torah portion said, see, I set before you. Blessing and a curse, life and death, proper way to be. And I'm sharing with you some of the Jewish tradition teaches you. Every one of you have set before you, by the Jewish tradition, a proper way to live, spiritually and morally. If you choose the proper way, if you commit yourself to becoming a certain kind of a person and taking on the beliefs and practice that create that person, first of all, you'll bless yourself. You will bless the people who live with you. They will thank God for your, even if they're atheists now, the reconstructionists, you know, in the room, okay, right? They'll thank the inner light, right, for the power in you that finally said, I'm going to make my life better. Your community will bless you. Here's one thing I found. One of the best things that makes a great Jewish leader, in addition to the fundraising and the speaking skills, the organizational skills, is the ability to work gracefully and wisely with other people. And that comes from an inner commitment to character. I and every one of us can grow in character and wisdom. The Jewish tradition gives us each time during the year, in addition to every day, a time in the year where this is our communal work. And my prayer for you is that you join me in taking this time seriously and receive the gift of our tradition as it pushes and guides and teaches you into lives of greater holiness. Thank you.
Of Naaseh v'Nishma. Now the Midrash has problem with that because Igdim Naaseh l'Nishma. You can't do something if you haven't heard anything. So a priori we're talking about people that are not complete, and they're, in other words, they are really slaves if you want to look at them. And just coming to the mountain didn't really do much to them, as the history later has shown, and as
correct,
you have so emphasized. So how do you, if you cut off the Nishma and only you do Naaseh, then why do you need the Nishma? Right.
Okay, let me answer your question. First of all, as far as Naaseh and Nishma, I believe that every important thing we do in our life is done with insufficient knowledge and a complete lack of understanding of what lies ahead of us. Let's think about it. Marriage and children. Okay? Now, the idea of entwining your life with another human being, discovering the mystery of their essence as they discover yours, growing in maturity and wisdom with them, and finding someone who can coax out of you the best person is a lifelong journey. I'm divorced and remarried. And one thing I realized that when I was divorced and when I wanted to remarry, and I very much wanted to remarry, was to find another person who had that consciousness that part of what marriage is living in the mystery of the presence of another person while building a life together and having a person coax out of me the best version of myself. I didn't know what that would be. So when I got married, I said, Na'aseh v'nishma. And when I brought children into the world, I have four kids, 23, 21, 9, and 6. And each one of them is a Na'aseh v'nishma. So I don't think there's any life of nobility or transformation in the world without saying, I'll obediently do it, but only if I fully understand what I'm getting into. Nothing of quality. My wife and I building a congregation. My choosing to become a rabbi and all the different things in this room. When you think about the things you've done in life, you said Na'aseh v'nishma. So here's something that happens to all of us. We say Na'aseh v'nishma, we're deep into it, and we realize what's required of us. The amount of wisdom and patience and duty required to fulfill that original obligation, and we want to back out. Now, not everybody gets a divorce, but they become unavailable. Or they flirt on the side, or people find ways not to live up on that to that original duty. Let's say, for example, or with children, people become impatient, they get frustrated, they get annoyed. And I can take every aspect of our lives where that original lucid Na'aseh v'nishma becomes clouded by the Yetzer Hara. So part of what we're talking about for me at this time, and I want to share with you one of my practices is, and I would just imagine, Rabbi Rackless, you do the same thing. At least once a month, I rehearse in detail why I became a rabbi. That I don't think is just this thing I ended up doing. Step by step, every decision that I made that got me to this point. So when I come up and stand in front of a group of people, I do it with a complete understanding of the history that brought me to this moment. And it's an intentional history. I don't want to forget one step of it. Because it's a hard life, I'm sure, as you can imagine. It's a lot of sacrifices to be made. Okay? But I'm duty bound to something. It's the same thing in every other part of my life. So the Na'aseh v'nishma is something that we all do in life in the most meaningful moments. We all have moments of weakness in moments of Na'aseh v'nishma. And this is the time to rededicate ourselves to those mysterious moments of lucidity where we commit ourselves into life that later weaken. But you know, in those mysterious moments is when we knew ourselves the best. It's in the moments of mystery where we have the most perfect self-knowledge. We have to trust and nurture those moments if we're going to become the human beings that we can become.
This is actually a statement. You know, earlier this week, Dennis Prager read the letter from your son in Iraq. And I want to point out, those of us who are fortunate enough to hear it, there's no question that he is an extension of you. Your wonderful belief in liberty, freedom, he is fighting and putting his life on the line. For people who are less fortunate and need those of us in the United States to stand up for liberty and freedom. So accolades to you.
Well, thank you. Appreciate that. For those of you who don't know, my son, I was in the Marine Corps 30 years ago. I actually joined 30 years ago this month. And served for 3 years, and my son went in the Marine Corps, ironically, on September 11th, 2000. And, of course, he thought he was going in for a four-year tour of, more or less, like I had, uneventful garrison duty, and he found himself in the Afghanistan theater, and back home, and then in Iraq. And I said in my article, let me just say one thing about this, is that when he went into Afghanistan, of course, I guided him toward this. I didn't make the decision for him, I didn't force him, but we talked a lot, and I told him why I did what I did. And he said, it sounds good, and he did the same thing. And I was not in a war, and my son suddenly found himself in two. And when he was on the way to Afghanistan, he had an email, and we had an extensive correspondence about American values and Jewish values. He never actually had to leave the ship. When he got to Afghanistan, the army was coming in, the Marines were pulling out. And same thing with the Iraq War. And many of the things that I'm sharing with you, I shared with him because he was scared. And he was rueing his having joined the Marine Corps. And what I said to him was, and people said to me, how do you feel about your son being there? And I said, and you may not all agree with me, but I believe ultimately, maybe not the reasons the president gave, but ultimately in the rightness of going in that part of the world and bringing some of our ideas of liberty and freedom. And when people say to me, how do you feel about your son being in there? I said, well, if it's not my son, it's someone else's son. So the idea that it shouldn't be my kid, but I believe in it. I said, what kind of belief is that? And then I said to my son, I said, you know, it's tough being the guy. I said, but we've talked, and you believe in this. And what you're basically saying, so you don't want to be here, is I want someone else to act on my beliefs. He says, you're right. If I believe in this, I got to be the guy there. And that's one reason I joined the Marine Corps. I mean, I joined the Marines because I believe that we have a great country, and we took a beating in Vietnam, and instead of running the country down, we should support our country. And I said, well, if I believe that, I got to do something. So I joined the Marines. Now, that may have been an 18-year-old excess. Maybe there were other ways to support my country in 1973, but that seemed right to me at the time. So I want to just say that that article came out of a lot of soul-searching about between a father and son whose son was facing the possibility of death and, you know, in a far-off land. And we both wanted a lot of clarity about that before he went in. And there was a moment when, you know, the very end of the email where you know, when Fast and Furious, those past couple of days, where there's a lot of completion on both of our parts, that he was living out his values and prepared to die for them. And that's the thing that I want to say with all of you folks. You know, my son went through a moment. He wrote me back that when he saw an RPG go over his head and he actually read the lettering, he knew he was in a battle. Okay. So, and I think there's nothing that gets your attention more quickly than an RPG, a rocket propelled grenade, going a few inches over your head. Okay. So I assume when my son gets back, we're going to have some serious conversation on what he wants to do with his life. I can already feel it in the subsequent emails. So you know what our tragedy is? No one's shooting at us. That's our tragedy. Okay. I'll end with one great scene from Hollywood. Did you all see, well, probably not, but The Fight Club? Yeah. How many saw it? Okay. So one moment in The Fight Club, which was a Yom Kippur moment. Okay? What happens? These two Fight Club guys go into a liquor store, and they ask the clerk, what do you do in a liquor store? He says, well, I'm thinking about going back to school, becoming a pharmacist. Okay? You remember what they did? They dragged him outside, put a gun to his head, and took his driver's license, and said, we know your name and address. We're going to come back in a year. And if you're not back in school, well ahead in your ambition to become a pharmacist, we're going to kill you. Okay? Right? And he leaves. And you know what I thought? I wish someone would do that for me. Okay? Think what you want to do. Some of you have a temper. Some of you are depressed. Some of you are ill-disciplined. Some of you yell at your kids. Some of you can't keep to a diet. Right? What if someone put a gun to your head and said, if you don't work that one out, I'm going to kill you. Okay? Would you have a problem with it? Right? You would probably be so on it. Okay? Right? And what's our tragedy? No one puts a gun to our head. That's our tragedy. That's our sorrow. Okay? But you know what, folks? This is something that we rabbis learn. We all have a gun to our head. It's called death. But we live in denial of death. We actually don't think it's going to catch up with us. So those of you who are nurses and doctors and hospice people and certainly clergy, we know. We know what's waiting for us. And I know that I don't have all the time in the world to get this thing right. And the greatest gift that I've been given is the Jewish tradition. The greatest gift that I've been given is the Jewish tradition that has made me conscious, aware, and giving me the tools to be the best husband, father, person I can be. And the ritual tradition, the narratives and the rituals every day bring to mind the aspirations of my soul, the modalities for working, and the vision of the person that I'm supposed to become.